From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. It's a big day for baseball fans. Barry Bonds is now the Major League home run leader with 756 career homers. On today's Fresh Air, we meet one baseball fan who's turned his obsession into a career. Zach Hample has a book on how to snag balls at the stadium, and he gives high-priced guided tours to games. His new book is a guide to baseball's rules, traditions, and jargon called Watching Baseball Smarter. Also, journalist Malcolm McPherson tells us about his satirical novel set in the early days of the American occupation of Iraq. It's called Hocus Pocus. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. When Barry Bonds drove a 3-2 pitch into Section 144 of AT&T Park last night to become baseball's all-time home run leader, he set off a bloody scrum in the stands for the ball, won by a 22-year-old man from Queens. But we know someone who, if he'd been in San Francisco last night, would have had a better-than-average chance of coming up with the prize. Zach Hampel is a lifelong baseball fan who's managed to make a career of his obsession. His first book was about how to get a ball when you go to the ballpark. He snagged over 3,100 lifetime, most from batting practice. Stay tuned and you'll hear some of his tricks. His second book is a guide to the game's rules, traditions, and jargon, designed to reveal its secrets to those who wonder why players spit and scratch all the time or what a hit-and-run play is. It's called Watching Baseball Smarter, a professional fan's guide for beginners, semi-experts, and deeply serious geeks. I spoke to Zach Hampel last week. Well, Zach Hampel, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to start by asking you a simple question about the game that's probably puzzled a lot of people. I watched Wimbledon a month or so ago, and I didn't see any of the tennis players spitting. And I never see soccer players spitting or lacrosse players spitting. But baseball players spit in the infield, in the outfield, on the mound, in the batter's box, and even between their feet in the dugout. Why are ball players spitting all the time?
Because they're disgusting, filthy creatures, and spitting is part of baseball's culture. But more specifically, baseball involves a lot of waiting. That's part of why some people are bored with baseball, but if you know enough, you can realize that a lot of the waiting is some of the most interesting action, in a way, because there's so much going on. But baseball players have to fill up that time with something, so they chew sunflower seeds, tobacco, gum, and even if they're not chewing anything, they just still have to spit, because I guess that's cool.
Well, and I always figured that, you know, a couple of generations back, most of the big league ball players chewed tobacco, and you have to spit all the time, and it just became the macho image of a guy who was steeped in the game.
Yeah, tobacco is actually banned now in the minor leagues, so I don't know if that's supposed to get players to not chew tobacco or if it's just supposed to motivate them even more to get to the major leagues because then they get to chew that stuff. There are even some players who've chewed it since they were so little that they've developed some kind of immunity to the tobacco juice and they don't even need to spit it out.
Now, you write in the book about why they scratch their crotches so much. Why is that?
Baseball players wear big, bulky plastic protective cups that fit in a special pouch in front of their underwear. Because the ball can take unexpected bounces on a little unlucky piece of turf, or if a base runner leaves a footprint in the infield dirt, it can make the ball bounce in strange ways. And these players have certain things they need to protect. And the thing with these protective cups is that they have styrofoam edges that chafe the inner thighs, and the entire cup itself inevitably will slip out of place. And it's pretty uncomfortable, and the players have to make certain adjustments.
Your book is called Watching Baseball Smarter. Who is it aimed at?
It's aimed at every level of fan. I should probably point out the subtitle, which is A Professional Fan's Guide for Beginners, Semi-Experts, and Deeply Serious Geeks. I wrote the book kind of with my parents in mind because they know baseball a little bit. My mom used to outslug other moms in family softball games, and my dad was a ball boy way back in the day for a minor league team. But they're not experts. They're not geeks. They don't memorize stats. I don't know if they could even name more than half the teams in baseball, but they know stuff. And whenever we watch big games together when I used to live with them, they'd ask me so many questions. And I figured, well, there must be a lot of other people out there who have these same questions. And there's a lot of weird, interesting, lesser-known stuff that I think even lifelong season ticket holders would not know.
Now, convince somebody who is not a fan that this game isn't a deadly, boring waste of time. Some folks just say, I just don't get it. I mean, the pitcher throws it to the catcher throws it back, they stand around, it happens again. How do you engage somebody who just doesn't get it?
That's not so hard. The first thing I would point out is that baseball really is a three-hour game that takes 3 hours to play. Other sports, though, basketball, for example, is a 48-minute game, which takes 2 hours to play, and football is a 60-minute game, which takes 3 hours to play. But baseball, there's a reason why it takes so long, and there's a reason why there's so much waiting and standing around. And the most basic way to get into that is the whole dynamic between the catcher and the pitcher. The pitcher has to know what pitch he's supposed to throw, and the catcher has to know what pitch is coming, because the ball comes in so fast, and there are different pitch grips and different spins that make the ball move in all kinds of different directions. The catcher has to know what to expect, but the pitcher can't tell him, okay, I'm going to throw this pitch now, and the pitcher can't give a sign or a signal to indicate that, because then the batter would see it, and the batter would know what to expect, and the batter would just crank the ball over the wall. So the catcher has to tell the pitcher what to throw, and he does that with a very complex set of signs, which he then has to bury in his crouch deep between his legs so that the first and third base coaches can't even peek in and see the signs. He has to look up at the catcher. The catcher also has to look up at the hitter every time he gives a sign to make sure that the hitter is not peeking back at him. And if there's a runner on second base, well, that guy is looking directly in at the catcher. So that just makes the signs even more complicated. You'll often see the catcher jog out to the mound and discuss with the pitcher, and they're basically changing the signs to confuse the runner on second base, so that guy will not be able to relay those signs to the hitter. So there's this whole cat and mouse game between every single pitch, and sometimes the catcher doesn't even decide what pitch should be thrown. Often the manager will be calling the pitches from the dugout, so the manager will be giving a whole set of weird signs. If you ever see the catcher kind of looking over his shoulder to the side right before he turns towards the pitcher, he's getting those signals from the manager. So the manager gives the signs to the catcher gives those signs to the pitcher in such a way that other players on the other team can't steal those signs, and then even the pitcher can sometimes shake his head and disagree with the catcher and say, no, I don't want to throw this pitch in this situation. So that's why baseball takes so long, because every pitch you have this kind of strategizing and scheming and deception, and it goes on from both sides throughout the game.
Right. But that whole process of negotiating the kind of pitch and the location of the pitch and making sure the batter isn't seeing it is pretty much invisible to a fan in the stands. They're just waiting for these guys to get it straight and for him to throw it.
Yeah, I actually think that baseball is more interesting on TV. Now, of course, nothing can beat the in-person excitement of being at a ball game, but the way baseball on TV is produced nowadays, you have so many different cameras with different angles, and you can see slow motion and replays, and you can just get right up close and see things that you would never see from the stands. Even if you're sitting in the front row behind the dugout, you're not going to pick up on some of the things that you can see on TV.
Can you think of an example of a nuance of the game that you think kind of opens the door to somebody who's just learning about it?
There's so much specific stuff, little rules and weird quirks that you can look for when you're watching baseball. I think a lot of things that many people would never realize, just even small things like you'll see a base runner often holding his batting gloves in his hands. Once he reaches first base, you'll see him take off his batting gloves and just hold them. And you might not even ever notice this, and if you do, you might not think that there's any reason, but the reason why he's doing that is so that if he does end up having to slide into a base, he's forcing himself to make fists because he has to hold his gloves, and he's protecting his fingers from getting stepped on and possibly jammed or broken.
Really? I have noticed people holding their gloves, and I've always thought, why don't they just give it to the first base coach? They want their fists balled so they don't injure their fingers.
Absolutely. Another thing that's, you know, just another little detail that you can look for, when the batter hits a pop-up right near home plate, watch and notice that the catcher will not fling his mask until the last second. Now, the catcher doesn't want to be holding his mask when he makes the catch because he wants both hands free. And if he flings the mask too soon, he might end up drifting as the ball drifts, and he could end up tripping over the mask. So he's going to camp out under the ball, make sure that he knows where it's going to land, and at the last moment, he'll fling that mask. And sometimes you'll even see that mask fly towards home plate and come close to hitting the batter or the umpire, and the catcher will then get a dirty look, but everyone really knows that that's just part of the game.
Right, and you'll often see the umpire looking because they know that mask is coming sooner or later.
Exactly.
Let's talk about some of the etiquette of the game. One of the things you see in baseball is that it's okay under some circumstances to argue with an umpire. I mean, you don't see football players running out and argue. When is it okay to argue, and when is it not okay to argue, and how far can you take it?
Technically, you're not allowed to argue balls and strikes with the home plate umpire. That's supposed to be an automatic ejection. Of course, you'll still see players complaining and managers flailing their arms in the dugout. But yeah, arguments, the whole manager umpire dynamic, that's part of the game, man. I mean, you can see arguments really get crazy. There are certain magic words, which I'm not allowed to say on the radio, but if those words are uttered to an umpire, that's an automatic ejection. But sometimes the manager will intentionally get kicked out of a game. Or even if he knows that the umpire made a good call, he might still have to run out and pretend to be protecting one of his players. So he'll pick up the argument on his player's behalf so the player doesn't get kicked out of the game. A lot of it is just used to motivate the players and really get the team fired up. You know, a good argument can even get the hometown crowd going. And yeah, umpires know that the manager is just doing his job. Of course, sometimes it can get pretty personal and ugly, but for the most part, I think everyone knows what's going on when there's a heated debate on the field.
So it's okay if there's a play, an out, like if there's an out at second base that's called safe or vice versa, the player can get right in the umpire's face and argue. The manager can charge out of the dugout and argue. However, on a called third strike, if the manager comes out to argue, he's immediately tossed, right? You can get away with a word or two, but you can't get in their face on a ball strike call, right?
Correct, yeah.
There's also this... There are etiquettes and conventions about pitchers hitting batters with the ball. When are the times when it's sort of considered acceptable for a pitcher to deliberately plunk a batter with a baseball?
In my opinion, it's never acceptable to hit anybody with a ball. I think there are certain times when you need to throw inside to move a hitter off the plate. They'll call it chin music. You know, if you throw a ball near the hitter's face, or you know, you give the hitter a bow tie if the pitch is up and in. But if a team, for example, is just really hitting the ball hard and diving out over the plate and they're reaching pitches on the outside corner and they're hitting home runs, some pitchers will intentionally hit a batter just because they're mad or to prove a point. You know, well, you can't knock me around. But in situations like that, I think it's appropriate to pitch inside, but maybe not hit someone. Of course, if one guy gets hit on one team, you'll often see a pitcher then they want to pick someone off on the other team, and it just sort of goes back and forth, and the retaliation can really get out of hand sometimes.
Well, and the terminology you'll see players using that situation is you got to protect your teammates. In other words, they hit one of our guys, and you expect your pitcher, even if he's going to get tossed out of the game, to go out there and hit one of their guys.
Yeah, and it's tougher in this new era with the designated hitter to the whole issue of protection, because in the old days, when every pitcher had to come up himself and take a turn in the batter's box, you know, if he wanted to hit someone on the other team, it was almost viewed as, okay, well, that's fine, because now you're going to have to stand up there too and watch what we're going to do to you. So it was like, you can give it, but you're going to get it. But nowadays, pitchers in the American League don't bat. So if they hit someone, they don't have to face the consequences, but unfortunately, one of their teammates often will.
Now, one of the things that will get you thrown at if you're a batter is what's called showing up the pitcher. Explain that.
If you're a batter and you hit a home run, 450 feet, 500 feet, doesn't matter, you don't want to stand there in the batter's box and pose and watch that thing. You don't want to finish your swing with your hands high over your head and flip your bat off to the side. You don't want to take your time running around the bases. You want to just put your head down, run around the bases, get back in the dugout, high fives, whatever, curtain call if the hometown fans call for it. But you see a lot of players posing and showboating because of ESPN and all these other sports networks that just show the highlights. And it's not enough, I guess, to just hit a home run and be great. You have to look great while you're doing it. And the pitcher can take that as an insult. And the next time that batter comes up into the box, boy, he better watch out.
And I think, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, that was much more likely to draw retaliation, right? I mean, you just weren't supposed to do that.
Not at all. Nowadays, the umpires have been instructed by the officials at Major League Baseball to prevent fights. So before you'll see things escalate on the field, often the home plate umpire will issue a warning to both teams. And that's pretty easy to spot. Basically, the ump will take a few steps toward one dugout and just point very emphatically towards that dugout. And he'll usually say that's a warning. You won't hear that on TV, but if you see the ump walk over and point, and then he'll walk over to the other dugout and do the same thing. And what he's basically saying is if anybody throws at anybody for the rest of the game, that pitcher and the manager will be ejected.
Baseball fan and writer Zach Hampel. His new book is Watching Baseball Smarter. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with baseball fanatic Zach Hample. He's written about how to snag balls at ballparks. His new book is Watching Baseball Smarter. You know, one of the interesting kind of partnerships in the game is the catcher and the umpire. And again, you don't see this unless you really look carefully for it, but these guys are standing close to each other all through the game. And also, they got a guy throwing a ball 90 miles an hour at them. And once in a while, a foul tip will catch, let's say, the catcher's ungloved hand. What does the umpire then do?
Yeah, when the catcher gets nicked up by a foul ball or a wild pitch that bounces and hit him, the umpire will sometimes walk the new ball out to the pitcher just to give the catcher a moment to recover. The ump might even bend over and pretend to brush some dirt off home plate, some non-existent dirt, just to give the catcher a break. And conversely, if the umpire gets hit, well, the catcher will sort of wander out to the mound and sort of make it look like he's discussing strategy with the pitcher. But it's just all for show, and it's professional courtesy. It's to give the other guy time to recover.
Cover from that injury, right.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll often see the umpire throughout the game, when he's in his crouch and the catcher's in his crouch, the umpire will lean forward to brace himself and place his hand gently on the catcher's back. It's just, these guys have such an intense relationship with each other. They're practically touching each other the whole game, and they're giving each other time to recover from being hit by the ball. And, yeah, the catcher tries to frame pitches. If a pitch is thrown, 2 inches off the outside corner, the catcher will just move his glove slightly to try to, convince the umpire and trick him that it was in the strike zone. And the catcher is very careful not to argue, when he's at bat himself, because he might make the umpire mad, and then the umpire won't give him the benefit of the doubt when the catcher is then behind the plate.
You know, Mike Schmidt, the Hall of Fame third baseman for the Phillies, once described being an at-bat, and a pitch came in that was low that an umpire called a strike. And what he said was he kept the bat on his shoulder, continued to look out at the pitcher, and said to the umpire, "It looked a little low to me." And he noted that the umpire appreciated him saying that while he kept his stance and looked at the pitcher. Why?
Mike Schmidt was not showing up the umpire. If he turns around, it's obvious right away that he has a beef with the umpire, that he's not happy, attention is drawn to the umpire, maybe he made a mistake. But yeah, just by continuing to look at the pitcher, you can't hear that if you're in the stands or even on TV. There aren't microphones right around home plate. So yeah, and the worst thing you can do as a batter is, drop the bat down and slump your shoulders and complain. Even worse than that would be, and I've seen this happen a couple times, instant ejection. If you're the batter and you think the pitch is a few inches outside, don't draw a line in the dirt indicating to the umpire where you think that ball crossed the plate. You just don't want to do stuff like that because umps have a lot of pride themselves. Even though no one is actually there to watch the umpire, yeah, you got to respect him.
My guest is Zach Hample. His book is Watching Baseball Smarter. A couple of things about rules and of the game. One of the things that's interesting, our producer Roberta Shorrock pointed out to me, that this is one of the few sports that doesn't have a standard field. I mean, the soccer field is always the same size. The football field is always the same size. Baseball fields aren't. Why?
Because baseball's beautiful. There are certain dimensions on a baseball field that have to be uniform, like the distance from the pitching rubber to home plate. That's 60 feet 6 inches, although back in 1893 and earlier, that distance was only 50 feet. So these distances evolve, but the distance from one base to the next is always 90 feet, and the batter's boxes are always 4 feet by 6 feet. Some of these things have to stay the same from one field to the next. But yeah, you'll see the dimensions, outfield dimensions, and the distances from the foul line to, let's say, the first row of the stands. Those will vary wildly from one ballpark to the next. And again, even though those can vary, there are some rules in place. Every ballpark that was built after 1958 is supposed to be at least 325 feet down the lines, like from home plate to the foul poles, and it's supposed to be at least 400 feet to straightaway center field. Now, again, there are some new ballparks that don't quite conform to that. Like, for example, AT&T Park out in San Francisco. It's about 309 feet, I think, down the right field line. And the Giants got permission from Major League Baseball to have a shorter distance there because they had to cram that ballpark into a small piece of land between a major boulevard and the water. McCovey Cove is what it's called now, where Barry Bonds hits all those home runs. So to make up for the short distance to the outfield wall, they built that wall really high. And actually, it's 24 feet high. And the reason why they picked that height is to honor their great player, Willie Mays, who used to wear uniform number 24. So there's rules, and then there's rules to get around the rules. But yeah, the height of outfield walls and even the surface. I mean, you have ivy at Wrigley Field, and you have padding, and you have brick, and you have fences, and you got that big green monster at Fenway. It's really one thing that makes baseball so interesting.
Baseball fan and writer Zach Campbell. His new book is Watching Baseball Smarter. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Somerset Maugham's novel Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Hocus Pocus. We talk with former Newsweek correspondent Malcolm McPherson. He's written a satiric novel based on his experiences covering the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad. And more on baseball with Zach Hampel. His new book is called Watching Baseball Smarter, a professional fan's guide for beginners, semi-experts, and deeply serious geeks. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with baseball fan and writer Zach Hampel. His new book, Watching Baseball Smarter, explains the game's rules and traditions and reveals some little-known facts about life in the big leagues. Baseball is played with new balls, but they're not exactly new. They're treated with mud, right?
That is correct. You'll never see a ball, if you ever catch a ball at a game, or if you see a close-up of one, it will not be brand new and shiny white. And basically, the reason for that is, well, it would cause a glare for the hitters. The sun or the stadium lights could reflect off the ball. And also, the pitchers would not be able to get a good grip on the ball because it's so slick right out of the box. So what happens is the umpires, or more often nowadays, one of their assistants, will rub mud on the balls. They'll take the balls right out of the box, brand new, and rub mud on them to reduce the slickness and the glare. And it's not just any mud. It's a special mud called Lena Blackburn Rubbing Mud, which is, I mean, there have been stories about this. This mud is collected at low tide from a tributary of the Delaware River in southern New Jersey. The exact location is a secret. The actual ingredients of the mud, because they mix other stuff in with it, is a secret. But every professional team uses this mud, and it's rubbed up on all the balls.
Comes in a can, right?
Yeah, it sure does. And those cans can last a long time because you just take a little bit of mud. I mean, you know, you're not just globbing the mud all over the ball. It's just a slight layer, just a little bit. You can, if you look at the ball really closely, you can kind of see the mud in the little teeny pores of the ball's surface.
Yeah, twice in my baseball watching career, I've gotten balls. One was a warm-up ball, but the ball that was actually a foul ball that I caught off of the bat of Phillies pitcher Terry Mulholland back in the 90s. When I got the ball, you could see it was brown with mud. It was different from the white balls that people had bought in the stands. You've made a bit of a career out of chasing balls in ballparks. You wrote a book about this, right? How to Get a Ball at a Ballpark?
Yeah, my first book is called How to Snag Major League Baseballs. I wanted to catch a ball from the moment I first was watching baseball on TV. You know, you'd see foul balls go into the seats, home run balls too, and fans would just go crazy to get him and act all obnoxious and give high fives. And, you know, I wanted to be obnoxious too. I wanted that to be me. And I went to games for 6 years before I got my first ball.
Well, it's interesting. I will confess that I looked at your blog and discovered an amazing coincidence, which is that you recently attended a game in Philadelphia, which I and a number of the producers at Fresh Air also attended. And in that blog, you said you got went home with eight balls, including a home run ball. I mean, I would almost think you're telling us tall tales here. Give us some of the tricks for getting major league balls.
I should point out that of those eight balls, seven I got during batting practice, and one was tossed to me at the dugout after the game. So even the home run ball was a practice ball. I have caught home runs during games. I caught Barry Bonds' 724th career home run last year in San Diego. But just a few basic tips for people who want to go home with the baseball: you got to get to the ballpark early. You want to be one of the first fans to enter the stadium for batting practice. If you have just a ticket for the game, that entitles you to show up early and watch the players practice. Bring a glove, even if you think that, you know, it's not cool if you're a grown-up to bring a glove, or it's, you know, it's unmanly. It doesn't matter. Put your pride on the shelf and bring a glove to the game. I bring a hat of both teams that I'm going to see. I own all 30 major league team caps, because if I can kind of suck up and look like a quote-unquote fan of the visiting team, they'll be more likely to toss balls my way. I can also ask for balls in about two dozen different languages, so I'm always asking foreign players in their native languages.
Whoa, hang on there. I'm Iguchi. Ask for me a ball in my native language.
Iguchi is Japanese, so I would say, Choto boro nagete kudasai.
This has worked for you?
Absolutely. I've gotten a few dozen balls by asking in Japanese. I got one at the last Mets game I went to. Masumi Kuwata tossed me a ball on the Pirates. It helped that I was wearing a glove, that I was the only fan in the section who knew his name, that I could speak his language. And I asked him in a polite way. I think the translation is just pretty much, please throw me the ball.
Go ahead.
I've asked in Spanish. I even used sign language a few times. There's a player named Curtis Pride who's 95% hearing impaired. And I used French once for a coach on the Expos. And I can even ask for balls in, you know, other weird languages, Bulgarian and Swahili and, you know, just Russian and German. Not that these are all weird languages, but in the baseball world, they'd be considered weird languages.
So you haven't found that Bulgarian infielder yet?
Not yet, but boy, when that guy comes up to the show, I'm going to be ready to say, Bili mi podal topkata.
Now, how many balls do you have from Major League games?
The current tally is 3,123.
Have you made a profession out of being a fan?
Well, in a way I have, because I've written two books about baseball. I also write for minorleaguebaseball.com, and I've started a new business where I'm now taking people to games and teaching them how to watch baseball, how to get the most out of it and have a few laughs in the process, and also teaching them how to catch balls if they're interested, and I'll even catch balls for them. So I've had a few clients there, and yeah, just trying to make my living in baseball. It's going pretty well so far, so I'd have to consider myself pretty lucky.
Tell me about this business where you take people to games. I mean, if I sign up, what's the experience like? What do we do?
We'd get there as early as you want. We could go for autographs hours before the stadium opens. You know, I know where the players' parking lot is and where the press gate is and exactly where to go. And, you know, just to get even more specific about autographs, a lot of people like to get baseballs signed. That's like the object of choice, usually. But a lot of people make the mistake of getting their baseballs signed with a magic marker. Sharpie is the type of marker that autograph collectors love to use, and it's great on baseball cards and photographs, but it's terrible on balls because the ink will bleed over time and the lines lose their crispness. So, you know, just little things like that I would know and teach someone if they were interested in autographs. You know, if they even want the full Zach Campbell experience, we can buy cheap seats and try to sneak past security and do it that way. Or, you know, we can try to get good seats and just sit in one spot. So, yeah, it's a full day's worth of fun.
And what's it going to cost me?
Well, it costs $500. I do have a money-back guarantee, though. If someone attends batting practice with me and we do not get at least one ball, if they don't catch a ball and I somehow fail to even get one myself to give to them, I refund all their money and the day is on me.
What is the best pen to use for a baseball autograph?
Use a blue ballpoint pen. The reason why you want to use blue is because all printed autographs are black. You know, when any fake autograph that's just like machine made will be black. So if you get something signed in blue, it sort of automatically indicates that it's authentic. I mean you could fake a blue autograph too. Also, black and other colors, red especially, will fade over time. So blue is less likely to fade, and it's more likely to show someone that it's authentic.
What are your off seasons like?
My off seasons are so relaxing. Oh, I love the off season. It used to be when I was about 14 or 15 that I would dread the last day of the baseball season because baseball really was the only thing that I lived for. But now there's just so much other stuff that I love and do, and it's almost like a 6-month vacation for me once the baseball season ends.
And what are the other things you love to do?
Well, I work at my family's bookstore, the Argosy Bookstore. I do some website stuff for them. I run a writing group. I'm a competitive Scrabble player. I like to spend some time going to the New York City Club and the occasional tournament. I also have a few video game world records, and I compete in some classic video game competitions. Everything I do is dorky to some extent or another. And, of course, I just have more time to spend with my family and friends and girlfriend, and I can focus on my writing more. You know, it's tough to set aside solid weeks at a time during the baseball season, but I can really kind of seclude myself during the winter and work on that stuff.
Do you have a favorite baseball movie?
Oh, yeah. I think I have to go with Field of Dreams. Just there was something magical about that movie that really just gave me chills, and it was inspiring, just a beautiful story.
Have you seen Fever Pitch? That's the one with the obsessive Red Sox fan who you kind of remind me of.
Yes, I saw Fever Pitch. It was a cute movie. And I don't think I'm quite that obsessed. I mean, when people come over to my apartment for the first time, they're always stunned, and their first reaction is, where are all the baseballs? Where's the baseball stuff? There's not really anything baseball in my apartment. I'm lucky enough to have parents that let me keep a lot of my stuff at their place, so that's where pretty much all the balls are and just other memorabilia that I've collected over the years, cards and autographs and stuff. So, I don't know, I try to maintain a pretty normal, quote-unquote normal, just everyday kind of feel to my apartment. I mean, there's some other stuff in my apartment that's kind of strange, like a 203-pound rubber band ball and some other things, but, you know, there's no baseball stuff showing.
You're an obsessive guy, Zach. I have to tell you this.
I take that as a compliment. Thank you. But now, come on, in all fairness, the rubber band ball, I started working on that thing when I was 4. Okay, so we're talking about decades here, and it's not like I work on it every day. Sometimes okay. I'll add a pound a day for a week, and then I won't touch it for a year. So, you know, you work on something for a few decades, it's going to be big and crazy if you stick with it. So it's not really an obsession. It's just kind of another one of those weird Zach things that people like to laugh at me about.
Fair enough. Is there a favorite player in the game today that you love to watch?
There are a few. I think right now I love Ichiro Suzuki because he kind of does things his own way. He just has such a weird batting stance, how he kind of runs up towards the ball and hits it. And in general, I love people who find their own special ways to succeed and to do things. And, you know, he came over from Japan, didn't know any of the pitchers, didn't know any of the tendencies of the players, and just succeeded right from the start, and he's dominated. And, he, you know, he's got that whole mysterious superstar thing going, which is also very appealing. He's just kind of like a... I've read some of his quotes, and maybe something has been lost in translation, but he says some kind of weird things, and I just love the way he carries himself and goes about playing.
What kind of weird things?
I can't remember the exact quotes, but, like, some reporter had asked him a little while back, like, what his dog's name was, and Ichiro said something like, I will not tell you because I have not received permission from my dog to tell you the dog's name.
Well, Zach Campbell, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Zach Campbell, his new book is Watching Baseball Smarter. Coming up, a satiric novel set in the early days of the American occupation of Iraq. This is Fresh Air. Events and decisions made in the early months of the American occupation of Iraq are getting far more scrutiny now than they did at the time. The lack of planning for the occupation, the failure to control looting, and decisions to disband the Iraqi army and purge Ba'ath Party members from the government are now seen by many as major contributors to the 4 years of chaos and violence that have followed. Our guest Malcolm McPherson covered the early occupation for Time magazine, and when he returned to the United States, he wrote a satiric novel based on his experiences. He shelved the book for 3 years, until it seemed to him the country was ready to re-examine the period. McPherson is a former Marine who was a foreign correspondent for Newsweek for 12 years and has written 12 other books of fiction and nonfiction. His new novel set in Iraq is called Hocus Pocus. Well, Malcolm McPherson, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, this novel that you've written, Hocus Pocus, is set in Iraq, and it begins with the absurd circumstance of some Americans and Iraqis that are traveling on a C-130, these huge military transport planes, and they're flying over Iraq and discover that there's this massive cargo on pallets underneath tarps, and we discover that the cargo isn't food, it's not weapons, it's stacks and stacks of American currency, 17 tons of it. Where did this image come from?
It came from actually my own experience, which was when I flew up from Kuwait. I was sitting across from, flying from Kuwait to Baghdad, and I was sitting across from this soldier who was all festooned in Mylar and helmet, and he had a machine gun and whatnot, and I asked him at one point, I said, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm guarding the cargo. And, of course, my ears went right up. And I said, well, what's the cargo? And he said, it's 17 tons of $20 bills. And it was that instant that I knew I had a book because, frankly, I mean, for the rest of the flight, I was absolutely consumed with the notion of how can I steal this money? I mean, what else would you think about if you were in a C-130 with $75 million. Underneath you on the land, there was absolutely no law that pertained to any civilian, or probably there was a military law, but I wasn't in the military. It really captivated me, and I knew at that instant that there was a book in this.
And to maybe belabor the obvious, why was the United States flying in 17 tons of $20 bills?
I suppose it was to pay off somebody or some group of people. I can't imagine that it was for any other reason. They did need, because the dinars, the Saddam dinars, were pretty worthless at that point. The only currency that held any sway would have been dollars, and I would guess that. But nobody was informing me, believe me.
The center of the American occupation was the Green Zone, this kind of enclave that was isolated by blast-proof walls in which high American officials and operatives and private contractors worked. Tell us, what were some of the, say, some of the physical characteristics of the Green Zone that really caught your eye?
Well, there were no blast zones at that point. They put those up later, or they were installing them as I left. But the Green Zone was a I mean, you had to have some kind of a... I used my Virginia driver's license to get in and out of the green zone. It was that easy.
So it wasn't so secure at the time.
Well, yeah, there was no need to have it that secure because the day I got there actually was the first... we were driving in from the airport and a Jeep went up in the air on the other side of the road, on that road between the airport and the downtown or the green zone. And it was blown up, and it was the first one to get blown up. It was the first roadside bomb, and it was very, very easygoing in a way. I think I was shot at once that I knew, and the other part of it was that there was a sense of adventure. I mean, we would go into town every night. We'd leave, go across the river. We'd leave the green zone. We'd go out to a restaurant of the few that were open. There were a couple of good ones. And we'd sit outside and we'd get a bottle of Suntory whiskey and sit around and talk. And it was mostly the guy. I was living at the Republican Palace at that point. I was living upstairs in one of Saddam's bedrooms with about 10 other guys and 8 trillion mosquitoes, and it was very hot. And then I finally got a slot in one of the containers in back by the swimming pool, which was air-conditioned, and it was quite nice.
And when you say container, you're talking about a shipping container that's been converted to a living space, right?
Which was standard
quarters in that area, right?
At that point, it was, and they had an air conditioner and a little shower, and it was actually quite nice. It was very cozy.
Clearly, there were images and thoughts that you brought back with you that made their way into the novel. But tell us some about your reporting in Iraq. What were some of the things you focused on and wrote about?
My assignment for Time was to get my nose under the tent at the Republican Palace, which I did.
Now, the Republican Palace, that was being used then for what?
It was being used as the headquarters of the Reconstruction effort. It was where Jay Garner had set up his group and where...
And the audience, Jay Garner is the general who first went over before Bremer to try and head the Reconstruction, right?
That's correct. Right. And it was now being used by Bremer and his people, and it was growing like Topsy. It was there were trailers being built in the surrounding grounds and trying to house as many people there as they could so that the entire green zone was then forming up as a place because... While I was there, they bombed rocketed the hotel that most of the people were staying in from the Reconstruction effort, and they knew that they couldn't stay in a high rise, so they decided to do what they could do by getting as many buildings around the Imperial or the Republican Palace as they could.
So you have this sprawling kind of American and foreign community of government people and contractors and military people, and what do you spend your day doing? Do people talk to you?
Oh, sure. I mean, I was talking to everybody from Bernie Kerik, who was the former police chief of New York City and who was sent over to start their police department, to the head of USAID. And I became very friendly with General Garner, who is a great guy. And I went all over the country with him from up in Kurdistan, the town of Erbil, down to... Basra, and we went to Hilla. And at that point, in fact, I even went down in Hilla. We were talking to a cleric, a Shiite cleric, and he said that he knew where to find weapons of mass destruction. And I, the next day, went off into the wilderness trying to find these weapons of mass destruction. Of course, didn't. I mean, it was...
Did he tell you, or did he tell the American government officials as
he
well?
He told General Garner, and he told a State Department guy who was there translating, and one of the generals who was in charge of that area. And I asked them what they were going to do about it, and they didn't indicate too much. So I found that, I mean, in terms of weapons of mass destruction in that case, that there weren't any. And, I mean, that I certainly hadn't found any, but that was no big deal. I went back to the palace that night, and I ran into, the defense intelligence guy, and he looked at me, and he said, I could have told you. He said, they don't exist. He said, just get over it. And I still thought they were there.
So in the 3 weeks that you were there, the officials inside the tent, so to speak, those in the Republican Palace, had at that point already concluded there would be no discoveries of weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
And yet Bremer and others remained obsessed with finding them, right?
Well, I think there was, they couldn't admit that there were none at that point, and I think that hope did spring eternal. And I thought that, you know, but what they were hearing from the intelligence people was, what I had heard was, just get over it. You're not going to find any.
We're speaking with Malcolm McPherson. His new novel is Hocus Pocus. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, we're speaking with journalist and writer Malcolm McPherson. He has a new novel based on his experiences in 2003 in Iraq. It's called Hocus Pocus. You know, you said that your assignment was to get your nose under the tent, that is to say, in the Republican palace where the U.S. occupation officials were established. What struck you in those 3 weeks that you were on the inside? What struck you as odd?
I think if more than anything, it was the lack of consensus of the idea that we were doing something there that had been thought out prior to the arrival. It was all very ad hoc on the back of envelopes and on scratched up on chalkboards and whatnot. And there were a lot of meetings of people trying to figure out what to do and how to do it. And these were big; these are the big picture guys too. I mean, you know, it wasn't just sort of the tactical stuff, the little details. And it was just very confused. It was a lot of what I thought was a great deal of trial and error. Let's see if we can get this thing to work or not. You know,
what about the Iraqi characters in this book? You know, you write a lot about Americans and their, you know, some are honest but misguided. Some of them are ambitious. Some of them are clueless. What did you want to tell us about the Iraqis from the characters in this book?
I think I wanted to tell people about what I saw among Iraqis was how they really were very pleased, excited actually, about having the Americans come in and get rid of Saddam, and how quickly that changed. One night I heard that the great football legend in Iraq, a guy named Ammo Baba, had been thrown in jail. And we went over there to the stadium where these guys were being held by the American army. And they didn't have a clue where Ammo Baba was. And we looked around and we finally found him. And he was with an older man who had just had a heart attack, actually, and was in very bad shape. We managed to get Ammo Baba out, and he went to Amman, to Jordan. He left the country. But I found that these guys were just, you know, very excited about, a lot of the people were very excited about what they were seeing happen to their country, and it just really turned bad quickly.
You said you, as a bunch of journalists, got this football star, Ammo Baba, out of jail?
No, it was the defense intelligence guy and myself who went over there. He had all kinds of clearances and badges and whatnot. So the army guy over there said, "Sure, take him with you if you want." You know.
Well, this is an interesting moment. Why was this soccer star arrested by what I assume U.S. military?
Yeah, he didn't know. They came in the middle of the night they, broke down his door. They accused him of some sort of complicity in something. He was with his wife. The other man was with his wife. They were terrified, and they just had the restraints put on them, and they were put in a Humvee, and they were taken off to the soccer stadium, which was kind of ironic. But he never knew. He had no idea why he'd been picked up. They never charged him with anything, of course, and there he was. So he got out, and we got him out, and you know, he left the country.
Well, let me ask this. How did you and this Defense Intelligence Agency official know that he didn't belong there? How do you know that he wasn't complicit in, you know, terrorism or insurgency?
Well, one thing that we supposed was, and it was a supposition, the question's a good one. We knew that Ammo had been on the national team, and a couple of years before he had been playing down in Kuwait, I believe, or maybe it was Saudi Arabia, and he had muffed a goal. It was pretty easy. And when he came back, Uday, who was head of the soccer program for Iraq, Uday being the son of Saddam, made Ammo do laps in the swim laps in the sewage treatment tank in Baghdad. And we knew that everybody knew that Ammo Baba was not a supporter of Saddam Hussein. He hated him, and he, you know, just had to keep his head down in order to stay alive.
Well, there is an Ammo Baba who is a soccer star in your book, and I think you tell the story of him having been forced to swim in a sewer. That's all true.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Malcolm McPherson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Writer Malcolm McPherson. His satiric novel set in Iraq is called Hocus Pocus. If you'd like to catch up on interviews you've missed, you can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of Mr. Piff, a novel by Lloyd Jones about the lasting impact of one teacher's lessons on a small island during a civil war. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable, on the web at grdodge.org. And from the Kauffman Foundation, featuring Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism by Will Baumol, Bob Lighton, and Carl Schramm at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Ayub Nouri was working with foreign journalists in Iraq as a fixer, an interpreter, guide, source finder, and occasional lifesaver in the war zone. On the next Fresh Air, Nouri tells us how he became a reporter with his own byline. Join us for the next Fresh Air.